Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is writer and journalist Lawrence Wright, whose new novel is The End of October, about a viral pandemic that upends the world. Uncannily, written just before COVID-19. He's joined in conversation by book columnist Greg Chagnon. And now join Lawrence Wright and Greg Chagnon.
On behalf of the Marcus Jewish Community Center and the National JCC Literary Consortium, I am pleased to welcome you to what promises to be a very special book fest in your living room event. Tonight's author is Mr. Lawrence Wright, whose new book, The End of October, is a pandemic thriller starring epidemiologist Henry Parsons, Deputy Director for Infectious Diseases at Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Dr. Parsons follows the emergence of a killer virus first detected in an outbreak of hemorrhagic fever in an internment camp in Indonesia, and which quickly travels across the world, including to his hometown of Atlanta. But first, a little bit about our special guest. Mr. Wright has been a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine since 1992, winning two national magazine awards for his contributions. In 2007, Mr. Wright won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction for his book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Which was adapted into a limited series in 2018 on Hulu, starring Jeff Daniels and Alec Baldwin. He has also written nine other nonfiction books, including Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and The Prison of Belief, which was made into an HBO documentary that won three Emmy Awards. Other books include God Save Texas, A Journey into the Soul of the Lone Star State, and 13 Days in September, about the 1978 Camp David conference and the struggle for peace involving Carter, Begin, and Sadat. Mr. Wright is also a screenwriter and a playwright. His one-man show, My Trip to Al-Qaeda, about the author's experiences reporting on the roots of Islamic terror, played off-Broadway and was filmed as a documentary for HBO. His five other produced plays include Camp David, and Cleo, about the making of the Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton 1960 film epic, Cleopatra. Mr. Wright has written one other novel entitled God's Favorite, a fictional retelling of the final days of the Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. His second novel is The End of October, published in April of this year, and the book we'll be speaking about this evening. So please welcome our very special guest, Mr. Lawrence Wright.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to virtually be back in Atlanta.
Excellent. Well, the first question, Larry, I want to ask you tonight is probably the most obvious question. So you've written a medical thriller about a deadly but fictional global pandemic, which was published in April of this year, the second month of an actual global pandemic. Yeah. So my question is, what did you know that we didn't know when you set out to write this book?
Greg, there's total coincidence about the publishing of it. I mean, I meant it to be a kind of cautionary tale, not a tale that, you know, to come out in the teeth of a real pandemic. But I read all the tabletop exercises, there were lots of them. I interviewed the experts. I talked to lots of medical historians and researchers and epidemiologists and virologists and immunologists. And my question really was, what would happen if something like the 1918 influenza came back in our time? Would we be any better prepared than our ancestors were? And one of the things that really struck me is that all these people in public health that I spoke to expected that something like this was going to happen. They didn't know when, but they knew it would happen, and they'd been preparing their whole careers for it. So they told me what would happen. I was not a prophet, as I've been accused of being. I don't have those powers. I simply put into fiction the anxiety and the scenario that most of my sources laid out for me. So, you know, the idea that nobody expected this, that nobody could have imagined what would happen, is simply not true. It was well imagined. There were many different tabletop exercises and playbooks and stuff like that that I read, even some by the Trump administration. And so that was the basic resource that I drew upon in order to write the novel.
Great. When did you begin work on the book? When did the idea for this book first strike you?
Well, the idea of the book actually originally, it came from Ridley Scott, the filmmaker, about 10 years ago. He had read the Cormac McCarthy novel, The Road.
Right.
And it's a post-apocalyptic novel. A father and son are wandering through the ruins of civilization. It's very scary. And Ridley's question to me was, what happened? Because Cormac didn't bother to explain. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was an interesting question. You know, what could bring down civilization? What would be such a powerful force that would cause our society to crumble? And nuclear war would certainly be one of those things. But because I had spent some time at the CDC writing about disease outbreaks when I was living in Atlanta, I have to say, Greg, I was so impressed with the CDC back in those days. The people I met there were so humble, but they were also ingenious and brave. They would go to these hotspots of disease that I couldn't get close to, you know. I thought they were noble in a way. And it seemed to me that the world of public health was just filled with heroes. And so that's just why I decided to set the story inside the world of public health. Now, Ridley never made it. It was my fault. I never figured out the ending of it, and I hadn't done the right amount of research. So when I decided to go back to it as a novel some years later, I decided I was going to, this time I was really going to dive into it. And I would do everything I could, learn everything I could imagine about it, and let the story unfold naturally. I always feel like if you know what the world is, then the story makes itself apparent.
So you've written both nonfiction and fiction in your career. So what was it about this subject that you wanted to tackle through the genre of fiction rather than just doing a straightforward sort of nonfiction narrative like a Douglas Preston book, The Hot Zone?
You know, the weird thing is, Greg, I'm actually doing the nonfiction version of it right now. The New Yorker asked me to write a kind of history of how we got to where we are. And it's so long that I'm turning it into a book. So it's the nonfiction version of my novel. I'm adapting my novel as a nonfiction book, kind of the reverse of what you would normally think. And, you know, they're both similar. Even many of my sources are the same. For instance, Barney Graham was extremely helpful to me in the novel. He is an immunologist at the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, which is Tony Fauci's shop. And I approached him at a time when he had more time on his hands. And he helped me design the virus in my novel and give it these properties, you know, and that, so that it was real. And then he had to also help me cure it. So that same Barney Graham is the guy that designed the vaccine that is being used in the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines.
Wow.
So it's funny to see not just Barney, but a number of the people that I interviewed for my novel and have now been interviewing for my nonfiction come into their own. I think Barney Graham and Jason McClellan, who worked in his lab, they should get the Nobel Prize if this vaccine turned out to be the solution, which I have a lot of hope for.
Yeah. It's fascinating to hear you say that you're doing now a nonfiction version of The End of October. So when you write, you know, how difficult is it to juggle sort of two different genres, or even a third, because you're a playwright as well? Is there one that comes easier to you, or is there is it the same sort of part of your imagination and part of your brain that you're using in these different genres?
Greg, I would say this. It's all storytelling. Mm-hmm. You know, there are different rules. You know, you have a different playbook, you know, and when I'm typically when I'm you mentioned, for instance, my play about the making of the movie Cleopatra, Cleo.
Yes.
I'm really drawn to actual events and real people. And it would be hard to invent more outrageous characters than Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, and Eddie Fisher. I mean, you could just go on the whole thing. You know, it was a wild experience. And but I wanted to know what really happened, so I researched it just as I would a New Yorker story or a novel, a nonfiction book. And I think of, you know, the fact that I laid out in that as being like boulders in a river. You know, if you want to get across the river, you lay out these stepping stones, and the facts are the stepping stones. Getting from one stone to another is the leap of imagination. And so that is my way of approaching fiction. In this case, you know, I had to invent a flu that could be devastating. And, you know, what flu was so devastating was the 1918 Spanish flu. So I decided I would build my flu along the model of the Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. In fact, the chronology of the progression of the disease in the novel follows what happened in 1918. And there's a reference to October in the title. 1918 October is still the deadliest month in American history. More Americans died in October of 1918 than have ever died before or since. And I thought, what would happen if something like that came along? And so that's the armature upon which I built the chronology of the end of October.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, tell us about your main character in the end of October, Dr. Henry Parsons. Who is he? What's the source of his deep interest in virology? And I understand that he was sort of inspired by an actual person.
I guess, you know, in putting together the character of Henry Parsons, there are elements that come from different places. Henry has been touched by disease himself. He has rickets. Mm-hmm. I had a friend who passed away a few years ago, but he had rickets. He was a professor at SMU. And I always admired the dignity with which he carried himself and bore this disfiguring disease. And Henry has also been touched by religious cults. And that's an element that's been very prominent in my writing, and it's always been a preoccupation for me. So there's that. I wanted to set him in the world of public health, and there are a lot of people that I've met in public health. A lot of people think I modeled him on Tony Fauci, and I had not met Fauci before I started writing the nonfiction version of this. So he wasn't the inspiration, but they're kindred. They're a lot alike. There was a real Henry Parsons. He was a country doctor in England in the 1890s and was asked to be a deputy epidemiologist during the influenza outbreak in 1891, I think. And he is the guy who demonstrated that influenza is actually spread by contagion, not by environmental gases or influences, which is where the word comes from. And, you know, he's totally forgotten figure, but it's a very important turning point in the history of epidemiology. So I kind of tip my hat to him by giving him the same name.
Yeah, that's great. So you write in the book about viruses. The total number of viruses on the planet was estimated to be 100 million times more than the number of stars in the universe. And you're also right, we wouldn't be who we are without viruses. Can you talk more about what you learned in your research about viruses, their danger, and their importance to our evolution?
I'm in the research that I'm doing now, you know, I'm constantly running into researchers or doctors like this guy at CDC who said, I just love infectious diseases. And someone else says, I love viruses. And it sounds anomalous. These are the people that are fighting it. But I kind of fell in love with viruses, too. You have to admire. These things are not even alive. You know, they are in a zone between life and something else, some other inertia, and they can't reproduce unless they invade our cells and use the energy that our cells have in order to reproduce. And that's the reason they infect us. They only want to spread themselves. That's their sole mission. And they're obviously really good at it. But there are, you know, viruses wedded themselves to our DNA. Many parts of our DNA are actually the remnants of ancient infections. And so our immune system, for instance, is built up on viral DNA. It's quite fascinating. You know, it used to be thought that, for instance, seawater was sterile, but experiments have shown you can dump a bucket into the ocean and pull it out, and there are millions of viruses in it. And we don't even know how many viruses there are in the ocean. They've traveled, you know, they're in the jet stream. They just move around with extraordinary felicity. And so you have to say, you know, viruses, you know, we wouldn't be alive without them because they eat bacteria. Mm-hmm. And so we're grateful for that, but they are a formidable adversary when it comes to human contagion.
Right. You know, one of the things that makes your book, I think, so thrilling is the main character, Dr. Parsons, is not only tracking this virus, but also trying to come up with the beginnings of a possible vaccine. And again, one of the great features of the book is how you are able to weave in some really fascinating information, not only about viruses, but also about vaccines. So can you give us just a little bit about Edward Jenner and 1796 and the very first vaccine? That's a fascinating story involving milkmaids. Can you just tell us that story?
Oh, sure. You know, smallpox was an incredibly devastating disease. I mean, not only disfiguring, it killed hundreds of thousands of people in Europe every single year. And those, many of the survivors, like 30% of them, were blind. And so it was not only a deadly disease, it was, you know, awful in so many other respects. So it's against that background that you have to judge the actions of Edward Jenner. He had a theory. It was a folklore that milkmaids did not get smallpox. Mm-hmm. Why would that be? Well, there was another similar disease called cowpox. And Jenner thought maybe, and it's not fatal to humans, Jenner thought maybe getting cowpox somehow protects you against smallpox. So he enlisted, I guess that's I'm using that word. I don't know exactly how he did this, but the 7-year-old child of his gardener. And he took some pus from a milkmaid who was infected with cowpox and injected it into this boy. What he did was make a little cut in the arm and then put the pus in it and seal it with a bandage. And then 6 weeks later, he injected the child with smallpox. Now, totally unethical thing to do, but it worked. And it saved untold billions of lives. And that was the first vaccination, because the word vaccine comes from the Latin vacca, which means cow. So that's where we get our word. And also, that vaccination was replicated by George Washington, vaccinated his troops, John Adams, his family, and so on, taking pus from smallpox victims after they had been vaccinated. It was a daring thing to do, but that's the origin of the history of our vaccines.
You're listening to writer and journalist Lawrence Wright, whose new novel is The End of October. He's joined in conversation by Greg Chagnon on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Equally fascinating was that little bit you included about King Charles IV and his efforts to sort of quell this smallpox outbreak in the Spanish colonies involving the 22 orphans.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, cowpox was essentially a European disease, and it wasn't present in the New World. And yet people in the Spanish colonies were dying of smallpox. So the king wanted to protect his colonists. And how could he do that? The vaccine itself would not survive the voyage. So what he did was he got these orphans and infected one of them. And they made the trip all the way across the Atlantic to the New World, infecting in serial fashion, one after another, so that by the time they arrived in the New World, there was a fresh infection. And they were able to take the cowpox that these boys were infected with and make a vaccine. And then they went on to China and elsewhere. You know, they must have got fresh orphans somewhere, Greg, but they continued this journey around the world, spreading the cowpox that was the vaccine for smallpox.
Wow, that's incredible.
Isn't it?
Yeah. One of the really frightening aspects of the book is the question that Dr. Parson and the others begin to try to solve. As they're solving the mystery of this virus, they begin to think there's a possibility that this virus has been manipulated in its early stages by man, right? And you explore in the novel this concept of national bioweapons programs and bioterrorism. So, you know, did you discover that in your research, that possibility about these efforts to turn for countries to turn viruses into weapons?
Yeah, very deeply. And I'm still interested in it with this current virus. I went to Fort Detrick, where we used to do our biowarfare research. And at that, you know, back in before Nixon was the one that instituted this treaty about biowarfare. But we experimented with horrible viruses, smallpox and other diseases as weapons. But who would ever want to use that? Well, there are people and actually nations that would. And the Soviet Union was working very hard on creating a bioweapons program. Smallpox, the 1918 influenza. There's a very deadly disease called Marburg. They were all put into warheads that would be used like bombs, but intercontinental, mounted on intercontinental missiles. And the idea was they'd send up these missiles and they would spread disease. Of course, diseases go where they want to go. And here's my concern about this, Greg. Mm-hmm. As far as Russia goes, as far as I know, they haven't destroyed those germs. And, I would like to have more investigation into what happened to that program. They had tons and tons of smallpox and Marburg. When I say tons, you have to remember that these are molecules. They were little minuscule things, but they created so much of it. They had huge bins of it. And that's very worrisome. it's also worrisome that sometimes these things leak out of labs. It's even happened at CDC that, you know, dangerous diseases have gotten out of the immediate lab. It hasn't spread into Atlanta as far as I know, but it could. And, you know, we've had instances of smallpox leaking out of labs in England, SARS in China. And so, you know, the research that was done to create weapons still goes on in a different way. It's called gain of function experiments, where, for instance, there's a horribly deadly avian influenza. I think it's H5N1. And it kills almost every time a human gets infected with it, it's fatal. And it's so far not very transmissible between people, but it could be. And some scientists experimented to see what would it take to make it a human disease, and it didn't take a lot. And they were criticized widely because it's like inventing the hydrogen bomb. But on the other hand, their defense was, it's going to happen in nature one day, and we should be prepared for it. So, you know, these are really weighty decisions that nations have to make. And having studied a lot about terrorism, I worry quite a lot about more nihilistic, anarchistic groups. You know, Aum Shinrikyo, that cult that was in Japan, for instance, they were experimenting with biological weapons, and they also used sarin gas and stuff like that, actually killing people. Al-Qaeda tried to do some experiments with biological weapons. You know, there are groups, even white supremacist groups, that have thought about it. So it's a dangerous area in which I hope that we can find a way to restrict the experimentation and also the access to these kinds of diseases.
You mentioned earlier that you've been thinking about this since COVID-19. So let me ask, from what you know about COVID-19, do you have any suspicion that this is sort of may have been had a man-made source?
It could be. Here's this, you know, the original story, Greg, was that it came out of bats and it probably infected a pangolin, which is a kind of scaly ant eater. And they use in China sometimes for herbal medicines. And perhaps it was pangolin in the wet market in Wuhan. They're called wet markets because they butcher the animals in front of you, and they have lots of fish, and water gets everywhere, blood's everywhere, you know, so they're wet markets. And they are, you know, amazing sources of diseases because animals are closely packed together in cages, and viruses and bacteria can pass between them. But there's no evidence that that was true. Later, after the story came out, the Chinese investigated and they found no evidence of the animals being infected. But they did find evidence that there might have been people at the Wuhan market that were infected. And most of the early cases turned out to have nothing to do with the market. So that theory has been disputed.
Right.
But it leaves open the question of where did it come from? And it happens that there are two virology labs in Wuhan that do a lot of experimentation on bat viruses. If they were trying to do the same experiment that I described a moment ago of taking a bat virus and seeing what it would take to make it into a human virus, and then somebody might have accidentally caught the disease and then walked out and went home, it's conceivable. It's also conceivable, and maybe a little more likely, that it happened naturally, that it passed from a bat to some other animal that was more congenial to the human genome. But the truth is, until we have a thorough international investigation of the origin of this virus, we don't know.
Yeah, it's quite scary. There's a moment in the end of October that really moved me, and it occurs when you are showing us the effects of the pandemic on American society, specifically Dr. Henry Parsons' family, his wife Jill, his two children. And, you know, Jill, Henry's wife, is sort of like a Penelope in the Odyssey character. You know, she's waiting and waiting for her, you know, her husband to get home as he's tracking this virus. And despite all that she's going through, trying to keep her family together and healthy and, you know, try to make it through where, you know, sort of American society is crumbling a little bit. There's a moment where she's hearing a mockingbird in a magnolia tree. And she thinks this, she thinks life, it's majestic and it's continuous. And here I couldn't help but think of one of the epigraphs you've chosen for the book, for the novel, the epigraph from The Plague by Camus, where you say that you conclude the phrase, the quote, but what does it mean, the plague? It's life, that's all. So those two things, life is majestic, it's continuous, what is the plague, but it's life. I want to know why you chose that Camus line as for the epigraph, and does it connect to some of the themes you're working on in this book?
Well, Greg, you're so perceptive. you unearthed my Ulysses analogy, and also the mockingbird. When I visited my parents' grave in Atlanta, there was a mockingbird in a magnolia tree, and that thought came into my mind. And so, you know, that it was personal, and I resonated with the Camus book. And the thing about viruses and, you know, and diseases, they're all forms of life struggling to exist. And we are too. And it's a battle in some respects. But, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that this is what life looks like. This is our plate that we have to, and we have to figure out a way to survive. What this leads me to think is that we have done a poor job of reckoning with nature. And, you know, the 20th century was a century marked by war and terror. I think the 21st century is going to be our reckoning with nature. Climate change and pandemic diseases are going to be, they're going to be the hallmarks of this century. And, you know, one of the things we have to do in terms of our mentality is to respect nature. You know, in all my research, I've been so fascinated by the fact that people discredit natural events. It's just something that happened. And like 1918 flu, 50 million, maybe 100 million people died in 1918. 675,000 Americans died. That's more than all the soldiers, American soldiers that died in all the wars of the 20th century, World War I, II, Korea, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, Grenada, you know, I mean, all those conflicts. And yet in 1918, they also killed more soldiers in 1918 than the war did. Nobody talked about the flu, really. The President Woodrow Wilson, who got the flu, and it may have precipitated the stroke that incapacitated him, never mentioned the flu. And then after that, it was rarely mentioned. It was in some ways buried, along with all the dead people that it killed. And it's only recently that we've begun to look back at it and appreciate the scale of the disaster. And, you know, so much of history, we tend to think of it as being shaped by wars. But pandemics have done their job as well. And I fear that in the century that we find ourselves in, they'll be the main influence.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you reference Albert Schweitzer in the book and his reverence for life. And I really appreciate when you're talking about this, you know, terrorism is in the background of this book. I think there's a terrorist attack in Rome that happens before the book starts. And I really appreciated how so many of these characters in the book are sort of saying, you know, life is so important, you know, and terrorism is all about the destruction of life. And, as Schweitzer says, you know, life is to be revered, you know, life is to be treasured. So that was a remarkable section of the book. It was, I mentioned the Odyssey earlier, and Dr. Parsons' journey through this book is quite Homeric, right? So right. He starts in Geneva and then goes to Indonesia where the outbreak occurs. And then you take him to Saudi Arabia, specifically Mecca, you know, in the midst of a mass pilgrimage. Why did you decide to take Henry and the virus to Mecca?
Well, after 9/11, when I was working on the looming tower, I knew I had to go to Saudi Arabia. I had to write about bin Laden, and they wouldn't let me in. And so how am I going to get into Saudi Arabia? I got a job as an expat worker. I was mentoring these young reporters at this newspaper in Jeddah. And one of my first jobs was overseeing our coverage of the Hajj. And I couldn't go to Mecca, but I was on the phone with them all day. They all got sick. People come from all over the world. They're bringing diseases from their neighborhood. They're greeting diseases from other places. They're pressed together very closely, millions of them. And then they all get on airplanes and fly home. And I thought, this is dangerous. Now, I'm not trying to pick on Muslims. Any mass gathering poses a public health problem. But it stayed in my mind that this could be the ignition for a worldwide pandemic instantly. It's not something that creeps across the globe, going from one country to another. You know, it lights up the whole world within days, and you don't have time. There's nothing to be done until, you have to figure out how are you going to fight a disease when you really have no weapons. You have no vaccine, you have no treatment, and you have to fall back on, the same strategies that we used in 1918, social distancing, mask, and hunkering down.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned earlier, the book was published in April. And since April, we've had, this whole world narrative of COVID-19. As the months have gone by, you must have been amazed at all that you got right in the end of October, including a vice president who's then assigned to be the head of a task force in the United States. So tell me about that, watching the COVID thing happening and saying to and thinking to yourself, I got this right. This part is very similar to what, I've written in the book. What was that experience?
Greg, I got way too much credit for being a prophet. I don't have those powers. I extracted this from research about what would happen. Now, there were things that were weird and creepy in some ways to me. The vice president being put in the task force, I thought, yeah, well, who else, right? I mean, that was not such a big leap. But there are little things that I think are really spooky, like there's a fly that plays a role.
Yes.
Unfortunately, the vice president had this fly land on his head. It's a little different, but it's like when that happened, I was, wow, that was, how did that happen? I thought, there were some moments that I thought were really unnerving when you project your imagination into a possible future. And then you're living on the edge of that future as you're projecting almost, then things happen and it's unsettling. And sometimes it was creepy. And then, it got to a point where I thought, stop, I don't want this to be, it's a pretty, it turns out pretty dire way in the novel. And it could, one of the things that I kept pointing out in the novel, this could happen. And then suddenly things very much like I predicted were happening. And I thought, don't let it go that far. And that's my fervent hope, is that it stopped at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is journalist Lawrence Wright, whose new novel is The End of October. He's joined in conversation by book columnist Greg Chagnon. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
My final question for you is, I want to just look at Dr. Parsons. And one of the things I thought was most effective and what you did with this character is describe the sort of spiritual journey of this man. And he begins the book. He's an atheist. You know, he totally believes in science. And as we were talking about before, he sort of is reacting against sort of the extremes of religious thought, you know, how it sort of imprisons the mind. But over the course of this book, including this great friendship with Prince Majid, who's the health minister of Saudi Arabia, he begins, I think, to change, you know, these ideas that he has. I wouldn't say it's a religious journey. It's more of a spiritual journey. And I wanted to know how important that was for you to include that sort of character arc in this book. And if it resonates with some of your own personal beliefs, your own spiritual beliefs.
Well, you know, it's my career. It's odd looking back on it. I've written about so many different religions and cults, you know, religious groups, charismatic leaders, and so on. Obviously, it's something that resonates with me at some deep level. As a teenager, I was very religious. And so I know the power that religion can have in people's lives. I've been impressed, you know, as a reporter. Reporters tend to be embarrassed about religion. I mean, we're all skeptics. And, you know, when somebody is religious, we thought, don't mention that. It'd be like having, you know, you know, talking about how old they are or something. You know, it's a fault. But my observation is that people can have strong political beliefs and it may not affect their behavior at all. And we all know people like that, right? But if you have powerful religious beliefs, it pretty much dictates how you live your life. And I thought we pay so little attention to the beliefs that power people's behavior. And so I've always wanted to look at, and I, you know, I'm not religious myself now, but I'm interested in it. And I respect the power of it, the power to do good and to do evil. You know, I've seen people that, you know, have, their lives have been transformed. They're in prison, you know, and it might be something like Jehovah's Witnesses, which, you know, we give very little credit to, but it can take a person's life and turn it around. And then I've interviewed, you know, the sons of Jim Jones, you know, who, one of whom had to go back to Jonestown and identify 900 dead people, everybody he knew, his family, his wife, his children, and a cult did that, belief did that. So I guess my character is a little like me in that he tiptoes into the edge of belief, respectfully, but with a kind of armor against being overtaken by it, because in the case of Henry Parsons, you know, he had roots in Jonestown. And so he's always aware of the power of belief to inflict terrible damage.
Thanks for that. So moving to the Q&A from the viewers, the first question, Larry, is a viewer has asked, you seem to move between fiction and nonfiction, as we were talking about. How do you choose your topics for books and decide it's going to be fiction or it's going to be nonfiction, and or if the subject will lend itself to theater?
Well, there's two questions. And the first is, how do you choose your topics? And this is the biggest mystery in the writing game. I mean, what do you want to write? I mean, And when I come to a point where I am about finished with a project and I don't have the next one, I'm in total despair. It is the worst period of my existence. You know, I have to have another project, but you know, what do you want to give a year or two of your life, or 5 years in some cases, to writing? And in some ways it defines who you are, because it allows you to express your interest in some subject that is going to totally take you over. Now, when you get an idea, you know, it's like a presentation. Hi, I am an idea. But it comes wrapped in a box that says, unwrap me, I'm a novel, or I'm, you know. I have found that part of it is pretty flexible. I have written, my editor at the New Yorker says, I eat the whole animal. I have written the same story, like God Save Texas is an example. You mentioned my book about Texas. I have written it as a nonfiction book. I'm producing a three-part documentary on it. And I am now working on a musical, all about the same subject, Texas politics. And, you know, once you find a really congenial subject, you know, I wrote a novel about Manuel Noriega that you mentioned. And I was working on the novel. Originally, it was a screenplay for Oliver Stone, and he didn't make it. And I thought, you know, years later, I'd write it as a novel, very much like this one. And in the middle of that, another director wanted to make it with Bob Hoskins. Mm. I thought, no, it's a novel now. And so we worked it out that the novel would come out before the film. But I actually finished writing the novel on the set of the movie. And, you know, it's an expensive way to write a novel, because, you know, there were scenes in the novel, like Noriega had a voodoo doctor, and they built a set of the voodoo doctor's studio. And so I went in there and took notes and then put it all into the novel. So I think that these subjects are the hard part, and then finding the form, you know, there's more flexibility in that.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask about your creative partnership with Alex Gibney. Didn't he also do the HBO documentary for Going Clear?
Yeah.
And he then also did the adaptation of your one-man show. When did that partnership begin? And tell me more about the nature of that work together.
Alex, for one thing, what you need to understand about Alex is his childhood nickname was Tiger. And he has those qualities. He's courageous. He's a lot of fun, but he doesn't back down from anything. And he's a great partner to have in the trenches when you're, for instance, writing about Scientology or something like that. He came to I was doing a one-man show about called My Trip to Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. And a couple of weeks, I did it at the Kennedy Center in Washington. And he came to see me there and proposed that we do this HBO documentary. And so we worked together. We traveled to Egypt and England, and we spent a lot of time together. I just love him. I just think he's a great friend. But he's also, you know, frighteningly productive. Greg, last time I checked, he had nearly 200 employees. You walk in, he's got a factory of documentaries, and he sponsors many young directors and producers and so on. But he's become the epicenter, to use a term we talk about in virology, of the whole documentary experience in America. And we're in contact nearly every week. You know, we talked a lot. He just had a documentary about the virus called Totally Under Control.
Yeah.
And, you know, I consulted a little bit with him on that. We recently produced a documentary about a friend of mine, Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi dissident who was murdered. So, you know, I think it's a very creative partnership, and we have a kind of shorthand language that we can use with each other. And we, neither of us depends on the other. We both have very, you know, active, creative lives, but I love the moments when they converge and we can work together.
Yeah. Is he going to do anything with the end of October? Or maybe that's something you can't say.
I don't know. I mean, Ridley has reassigned himself. He's attached himself to the project again. So
Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott. Yeah. So my lesson in Hollywood is you don't spend the money until you eat the popcorn. So I have no idea what's going to happen with it, but I would work with Alex on anything.
Yeah. Another question from a viewer. What do you make of some people simply denying the reality of COVID-19? How does that square with your study of religion and cults as a way for people to deal with difficult to explain events? And I'll just add to this, there's a line in the book that I want to mention that I thought was really thought-provoking, is when Henry wonders if humanity was once again sort of sleepwalking toward a pointless civilization annihilating conflict. With that sleepwalking element, I think it pertains to this person's question.
Yeah, I agree. I'm very concerned about it, to be frank. You know, we're in a period of extraordinary irrationality. You know, your state of Georgia just elected a QAnon representative congresswoman. Really? But, you know, it's gotten to the point where nonsense has the same standing as, reality and science. And that's a very dangerous situation to be in. I can't really think of a period in history where it's been exactly like this. There have been populists that have bamboozled people and so on, and there have been charismatic leaders that have led cults down to destruction. But to have 30-40% of Americans believing things that are obviously not true, have no evidence to back them, and it's a very dangerous, indigestible lump in our system, and I don't know how we get past it, but we have to. I think education, moral leadership, you know, there's a lot of stuff that we can do that can help this nation get past this very dismal, dangerous period that we're in. But, you know, if we don't, then I am very concerned. You know, there's a scene in the book where there's nothing on the radio but Alex Jones. And, that's my worst nightmare. But, that could happen.
Right. And Larry, the final question, a viewer asks, what's your reading now? And I just want to piggyback on that question. You know, what are you reading now? But also, any of the people who have read your novel who want to read more plague narratives, could you recommend to us where we should go next in our plague reading?
Well, all right. What I'm reading now, you know, the burden of being a writer is you rarely get to read books you want to read. Mm-hmm. I'm always researching. So I'm reading that Richard Preston book that we talked about. I just interviewed Mohammed Zaman and Deborah McKenzie, who have written Deborah wrote a book about COVID, and Mohammed has written about resistant bacteria, I should just say. And they're fascinating. So I've been reading those. I'd much rather curl up with a fun novel, but I don't have a lot of reading time outside of my research when I'm buried in a project as I am now. Now, as far as plague books, the Camus book was great. And you know, Daniel Defoe wrote A Journal of a Plague Year in the plague in London in the 17th century. And what's really interesting to me about that, he was like 6 years old when that plague happened. And he writes it as if he's experiencing it. And apparently he downloaded some uncle or something like that. But it's very modern. And it reminds me of the nonfiction novel you know, when that Norman Mailer, you know, was experimenting with that. It, you know, if you just look at it, you know, think about its birth, it's very intriguing. The truth is, there's very little plague literature. We talk about these, but, you know, we mentioned earlier that, you know, a lot of the plagues have been forgotten. But in the Black Death, for instance, Boccaccio's Decameron is fascinating because I interviewed this woman who was a medical historian in Bologna, and I asked her how this current contagion compares with other epidemics in the past, and she said it reminded her of the Black Death, not because of the scope of its killing, because it killed a third of Europe, but in terms of the fact that it was what began the process of closing the door on the Middle Ages and opening the door to the Renaissance. And you can see in the Boccaccio the opening notes of the Renaissance. It's, you know, there's the priests are object of pity and ridicule. You know, the old pious Middle Ages have, you know, are essentially being buried along with thousands, millions of corpses. Of all the plague literature, my very favorite is Pale Horse, Pale Rider. Catherine Ann Porter actually did get the 1918 flu. Her hair fell out. She was bald. When it came back in, she had white hair. She was a young woman. She was working for a newspaper in Denver, and they had actually put her obituary in type. And then she survived and wrote this majestic story about having the flu, and it's so it's ethereal, but you just know it's real. Every fantasy inside it is buried in something that actually she experienced. And so, I mean, there are other books that I could mention, but I think that those are the ones that come to mind.
Yeah, I want to add my favorite plague narrative is Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel.
Yeah, it's much more contemporary, and it's classified with mine as science fiction, which is interesting because I hadn't really thought of myself as a science fiction writer. But, you know, when you write about something that hasn't happened yet, then you get put on that part of the shelf.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Larry. I really appreciate your time and your book, The End of October, is a fantastic read. Thanks for joining us, and stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned. Thanks, Larry, very much.
Greg, I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was writer and journalist Lawrence Wright, whose new novel is The End of October. He was joined in conversation by book columnist Greg Chagnon. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.